Welcome to the Birmingham Vineyard podcast. We hope you find it insightful and encouraging.
If you want to find out more about us, why not check out our website, birminghamvineyard.com.
Excellent. Okay, I'm delighted to be here with you this evening. Our passage today comes from the Gospel of Luke. It is from chapter 23, verses 32 to 43. And if I do this, it's going to start having it on the screen. Excellent. Two other men, both criminals, were also led out with him to be executed, him being Jesus. This is the scene in the life of Jesus where he has been tried. He's about to be executed. When they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there along with the criminals, one on his right and the other on his left. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. The people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, "He saved others. Let him save himself if he's God's Messiah, the chosen one." The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and they said, "If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself." There was a written notice above him which read, "This is the king of the Jews." One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God," he said, "since you are under the same sentence. We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus answered him, "Truly, I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." This is both a weighty passage, but one that is full of hope, one that is full of joy. It is one that reflects the heart of Jesus, of his message, of his mission. It sums up exactly who Jesus is, what he came to do, and what he comes to do for us. Jesus' death on the cross is the cornerstone. It's like the building block upon which all of our faith stands and upon which our relationship with him stands too. Its importance is impossible to underestimate. That's why we spend time singing songs about it. That's why we celebrate communion to remind ourselves of it. His death is historically verifiable, but it's more than just a historical event. His death on the cross is profoundly symbolic, but it's more than just a symbol. His death on the cross was and is the most significant point in history and in spiritual life, which matters to every single one of us as individuals and matters for our whole world. And yet, for some of us, it can still remain difficult to relate to. Historically, it can seem distant. After all, what does the death of a controversial rabbi in the first century in Jerusalem mean to us? There were other messiahs who were also crucified. Spiritually, there are realms that are invisible, and perhaps we only just glimpse or begin to understand, especially for us in the 21st century in the Western world. How can we begin to understand something that we just can't see? And symbolically, the very familiarity of the cross can sometimes, I think, make it difficult for us to come to it with the right perspective. We see crosses made as pieces of jewelry, like this one, as parts of architectural design. We see them in icons, we see them in pictures, and it is easy for us to forget that this was an excruciating, humiliating form of execution. And what's happening in this passage is absolutely shocking. It is scandalous. There is a reason that Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of Christ, is as an 18 certificate. Scholars regard it as quite a historically accurate depiction of the Roman forms of punishment and torture. It is not easy viewing at all. And mindful of the fact that there will be people in the room this evening that are not 18, I'm not going to show you a clip of it here. So I think this poses us with a challenge. Even if we're very familiar with this story, how do we come to the cross with a perspective that helps us understand what is going on here? And what in particular does Jesus encounter with the two criminals who are the focus of our talk today? What do they have to teach us? So, first of all, they had questions for Jesus. And I want to say at the outset that it's a really good thing to have questions about Jesus and to have questions for Jesus. Because the good news that Jesus announced with his ministry was not a form of manipulation. It was not another version of an oppressive system that was maintained through unquestioning brute force. Jesus never forced anyone to join his kingdom. He invited them. And many times he started that by having a conversation with them. He would have questions for people. They would have questions for him. And it's really good to have questions. We live in a world, in a context, where people have questions all the time. We live in this kind of postmodern, post-Christian world where everything is questioned. And on the one hand, that's really challenging. But on the other hand, that gives us an amazing opportunity to have questions and to talk about people's questions with them, to take those questions really seriously and to take the answers we find really seriously too. What we also see in this passage that there are different ways to respond to Jesus. There are two criminals, one on his right and one on his left. You'll note I had to think about the right and the left. Okay, so two people, two responses. They had different questions, different encounters with Jesus. And in Luke's gospel, we have this panorama of a whole set of eyewitnesses that had different encounters with Jesus and different responses to him, starting right from the very beginning where we have Zechariah on the one hand, Mary, the mother of Jesus, on the other, and responding with doubt and faith to their angelic visitors. We have Simon the Pharisee, who failed to honor Jesus, and Mary of Bethany, who poured perfume all over his feet. We have Martha distracted. We have Mary sitting as a disciple. We have the rich young ruler who went away sad because he loved his wealth too much, and Zacchaeus, who gave away half his money to the poor and repaying those he cheated by 400%. And in our passage, we've got another pair. We've got these two nameless criminals, both of whom also respond differently. And the way that Luke shows us these different people and the way that they compare and they contrast is important because it reminds us that there is always a choice in how we respond to Jesus. We are not robots. We're not machines that have been programmed to have an automatic response. God made you and me and us to be people, and he made us with free will. We can choose how we respond to him. We can choose how we respond to the questions that he asks us, and we can listen to what he says when we have questions for him. So what were the questions that the people in the scene that we're looking at had for Jesus? Well, they all center on one thing. They were asking Jesus, essentially, who are you? And this is a question that we need to think about as well today. So who do you think Jesus is? What expectations have you got of him? Do you think he's near? Do you think he's far away? Is he close? Is he distant? Is he benevolent? Some kind of cuddly, clean Christian? Clean Jesus, like Tony was describing a few weeks ago. I sometimes think it would have been easy if I had been around in first century Israel. If I had been a follower of Jesus and actually been with him, been able to see him face to face, of course I would have believed. But what this passage shows us, in fact, what the whole of Luke's gospel shows us, is that it's quite possible to encounter Jesus and to come to very different conclusions about who you think he is. And some of the reasons that people came to these different conclusions was rooted in the expectations that they had of him. And in this sermon series, we've been talking a bit about those different expectations that people, particularly in this historical moment, had of Jesus, the kind of expectations that came to the fore. So for first century Jews, they were asking Jesus, are you the one that we've been waiting for? Are you the Messiah? Are you the one who is going to restore and rescue Israel? Are you the one who's going to overthrow our Roman oppressors and put an end to this long 400-year silence that lasted from the end of the Old Testament prophets through to the time of John the Baptist? And so in Luke 23, before the bit that we get to, we see the religious leaders asking Jesus, on whose authority do you act? We see Pilate asking him, are you the king of the Jews? We see Herod, who wanted to be entertained, who was longing to see Jesus because he wanted some spectacular sign, asking Jesus lots of questions, and Jesus just refuses to perform and says nothing to him whatsoever. We see the soldiers saying, if you're the Messiah, why do you not save yourself? And we have our two criminals who've got two different questions and come to two different conclusions, one of whom questions whether Jesus really is the Messiah, and the second of whom recognizes that Jesus really is the King of the Jews. And if we look at these questions, especially the question from the first criminal, we can see actually, if you're coming from the perspective where you think the Messiah is going to be the one who overthrows Rome, you've got some very good reasons to doubt that Jesus is the Messiah. Because from that perspective, on the surface of things, Jesus looks exactly like a failed Messiah at this point. He is not saving Israel by overthrowing Rome. He is willingly giving up his life by being executed by the Roman authorities. On the face of it, he's not setting captives free, as he announced in his inaugural sermon in Luke 4. He's not getting the two criminals down off the cross and setting them free. The two criminals who are on either side of Jesus are not exactly occupying the seats of honor that James and John had in mind when they asked if they could sit on the right and the left of Jesus when he came into his kingdom. We can perhaps understand from this context why it is that the women are weeping, why the disciples are not even close by him in this part of the story. We might ask, where is the good news that is being proclaimed here when it looks like disaster? And as I've been thinking about this passage, I was thinking, well, sometimes we get really disappointed in Jesus too. Sometimes it seems like perhaps he's let us down, or it looks like he's let us down. But perhaps there's something going on behind the scenes that is a bit bigger. Because the answer to where is the good news depends very much on who you think Jesus is and how you understand what the new kingdom is that he was announcing. So we sometimes talk about Jesus' kingdom being upside down. Now, I wanted to give you an illustration here. Some of you know that I'm very fond of yoga, and for the last year, I have been trying to learn to stand on my head. We spend a lot of time in yoga doing things upside down. We spend a lot of time in what they call inversions. Adam, in fact, also does an inversion every evening, apparently. He does more practice than me, so really I should have Adam here standing, well, not standing on the stage, standing on his head on the stage. But we decided that it would be too much for Aaron's health and safety for me to stand on my head, and my children are much too worried that I actually wouldn't manage it. So I'm not going to stand on my head. But actually, what I want you to do is to imagine what it's really like to have your perspective flipped and to think about that in relation to what Jesus is doing here. Because his death on the cross shows us exactly how he was turning things on their head. So Jesus' mission was not to overthrow a particular political regime, certainly not to overthrow it by violence and by force. His teaching was to love your enemies, to go the extra mile, to lead by serving others and not to choose retaliation, not to overcome your oppressors by leading a rebellion against them. And we see Jesus embodying this entirely on the cross when he prays, Father, forgive them, and he chooses to let the Roman forces execute him, even though Luke makes it really clear that he is innocent. We see Jesus being executed right alongside two criminals whose charge is exactly that of rebelling against Rome. So in the translations that you might be familiar with, they're described sometimes as thieves. The word is actually lestes, which means bandits. So Tim Mackey has a really great podcast about Luke, and he describes the way that these bandits, even bandits, doesn't really get us very far, because what it doesn't capture is that what these men were kind of freedom fighters. So they were like Robin Hood figures who would be kind of taking back or rubbing against the Roman authorities to try and take back what was rightfully theirs. So Tim Mackey points out that it's actually would have been really normal for tax collectors like Matthew to carry a knife with them because they could fully expected to have been attacked by these kinds of bandits or freedom fighters. So we have Jesus right in the middle, who is not rebelling against Rome, refusing to retaliate, and on either side of him, these two rebels who were exactly doing that. Incidentally, and as an aside, it's fascinating to me, or actually mind-blowing to me, just how inclusive and amazing Jesus' kingdom is. Because if we look at his disciples, we see that not only do we have Matthew the tax collector, we also have Simon the Zealot, who would also have been a former freedom fighter in the same way. Both together, both in Jesus' kingdom, both following him. Okay, let's come back to Jesus. So Jesus' choice not to rebel, not to retaliate, to allow himself to be executed, It's not just some kind of pacifist gesture. There is something else going on here. Because if Jesus had only been the kind of Messiah that his contemporaries expected, then he could only have dealt with the oppression in that place, at that time, and in that context. He would only have been dealing with a very particular social and political problem. And what Jesus was doing was so much bigger than that, because his mission was to deal once and for all with the broken condition of the human heart and to conquer the power of evil forever. And that is what makes his death on the cross absolutely crucial for us today, just as it was for the two criminals who hung next to him then. Because we might not be under Roman oppression, but our world is still oppressed and broken. We only have to look at history. You've only got to look at the news. You only have to open up your social media feed and you can see this. Social inequality, crime, heartbreak is everywhere. And it's not just some kind of abstract problem. It's actually rooted in the choices that people make. And the problem that without God, our human hearts have got this tendency to make choices that put ourselves first. And this choice to be independent, to live not in dependence on God, to live on our own terms, is what the Bible calls sin. Now, although the reality is that actually everybody sins all the time, in Western culture, we don't actually talk about sin very much. Now, some of you will know that I look at words a lot for my job, and so I like to look at the patterns of words. And what I'm showing you on the screen here is a picture of a Google Ngram. So an Ngram is a way that Google searches through all the books that it holds in its system, and it counts how frequently that word occurs. And what you can see here is that the word sin is just not used very much anymore. Is really started to fade out of the way people talk. And actually, we're much more comfortable, in a bizarre way, talking about shame rather than sin. And while shame is very real, it's the feeling we get when we've done something wrong, it's actually misleading to replace sin with shame. Not least because that kind of masks what the problem is. Because the problem is not that we feel bad when we've done something wrong. It's actually the whole gamut of something wrong we've done in the first place, and then the effects that this has, which includes shame, but includes a whole lot of other things too. So what does the Bible say when it talks about sin? Well, in our English translations, the word sin actually is used to translate at least three different words. Now, you'll have to forgive me for going a bit kind of Greek nerdy with you here, but just go with me because I think it's actually really helpful to understand this. So there are three words that the Bible has for sin. And the first is hamartia. It means missing the mark. We've used that phrase already this evening. And it's like a picture of when an arrow doesn't quite hit where it's supposed to go. And a way of thinking about that is not just we're arrows that just don't quite make it. It's that actually we're designed, we have an original design that God had for us, which is to be fully connected with him, fully designed to be with him, free of sin and shame. And actually, none of us make that at all. We all fall short of that original design that God has for us. The second word is adikia, and it means unrighteousness or a deed that violates the law. And so that's when you know what you should do, but you cross the boundary. You do the wrong thing. So maybe it's you've broken the speed limit. Maybe it's that you've chosen to gossip about somebody. All kinds of things. And then we have poneria, which means depravity or it's wickedness of a vicious kind. So, I mean, we can think of really horrific wrongdoing there. So we have this whole range of sin and all of it, from the not hitting the mark kind through to the gravest kind of evil, God hates all of it. He hates sin and he hates evil because he hates what it does to us and he hates what it does to our world. And he wants our world to be free of evil and sin because he is both loving and merciful and completely holy and just. In Exodus 34, we can see this when God tells Moses his name. He says, I am the Lord. I am the Lord, the merciful and gracious God. I am slow to anger and rich in unfailing love and faithfulness. I show this unfailing love to many thousands by forgiving every kind of sin and rebellion. Even so, I do not leave sin unpunished. So how can God express his holy love? How can he forgive sin but not compromise on his holiness? And in his holiness, how can he judge sinners without losing his love? This is the conundrum that John Stott wrestles with in The Cross for Christ. He needs a way to deal with that sin, to defeat its power once and for all, and to remain completely loving. And the only way to do that was to take the full force of the judgment of sin on himself whilst remaining completely innocent. The mission of Jesus, Jesus dying on the cross, is his answer. And that is what makes understanding who Jesus is really scandalous. That was the case for his contemporary audience, and it's still scandalous for lots of people today. Scandalous actually kind of means stumbling block. It's a thing that you can fall over. If Jesus had been an innocent man, then his death as a martyr would have been a miscarriage of justice. But it would not have done what he said he was doing, which was to inaugurate a new kingdom where evil was defeated forever. And what was utterly scandalous was that Jesus did things like forgiving people's sin, which was something that only God could do. So what has Caiaphas the high priest tearing his robe was not that Jesus was acting like the Messiah, but doing it in all the wrong ways. It was that Jesus was the embodiment of Yahweh. He was both man and also God. And in dying on the cross, he shows us exactly who God was and is. For this was God's master plan, that he would take on himself the sin of the world, and in Jesus' death on the cross, take the full penalty of every kind of sin and rebellion, every point of falling short, from every piece of careless gossip through to genocide. So let's think about what that might mean for us today. And this might be an illustration that you've heard before, but let's just remember it because it's useful, I think. So I'd just like you to shut your eyes for a moment. I would just like you to think about how much money you've got in your bank account. Oh, some of you are happy. It's not going to stay happy for a moment. We'll go a bit sad for a moment, then we'll go happy again. Now, actually, what I want you to do is think about something that you know that you've done wrong. Now, I want you to imagine that you're in a court, and the judge is there, the judge is God, and he says, okay, there's a penalty for that thing that you've done wrong. And that penalty is something like, let's imagine 10,000 times the amount that you've got in your bank account. It is an amount you can't possibly repay. But then what he does is he comes down and he says, here you are, I'm giving you all of the money to cover that. And not just for this, but for every single thing that you've done. And at this point, you've got a choice. What are you going to do? Are you going to accept the offer? Or are you going to say, no thanks, I don't need it? Okay, you can open your eyes again. Because your response depends not just on who you think Jesus is, but also who you think you are. And the response of the two criminals helps us see how our understanding of who we think we are makes all the difference. So the first criminal's question shows us in a way that he's really self-interested. Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us. Get me out of here. It's like, oh, I'd like Jesus in my pocket, please. I'm just going to get him out when I'm in a point of trouble. And like, oh, will you please save me? No acknowledgement that he has done anything wrong. He doesn't understand the situation that he's really in. Whereas the second criminal clearly does. Sorry, I've lost my place. We'll come back. He says we deserve to die for our evil deeds, but this man hasn't done anything wrong. The second criminal knows he is getting the penalty he deserves. He knows that he's sinned, that he's broken the law, that he's rebelled. He knows he's messed up. But what is amazing, and we haven't got it here in this part of the passage on the screen, but I'll read it to you. When the second criminal says, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom, that is all that Jesus needed. Because his answer was straight away, today you will be with me in paradise. And in Jesus' response, we can see what his offer is also to us. It is to return us to our original design. It is to be with him. And the reference here today to be, you will be with me in paradise, is not a quote from a Phil Collins song. You have to be of a certain age to get that. Sorry if those of you that are too young, you have to get your parents to pay you some 1980s, 1990s music on the way home. So paradise is actually a loanword from Persian, and it is a reference to a beautiful garden, and not just any old garden, it is a garden of fruit trees. Anybody remember any other gardens with fruit trees that come near the beginning of the Bible? It's an echo of the Garden of Eden and a picture of being with Jesus that is our original design, to be completely free from sin and shame. And in Jesus' answer to the criminal, he tells him that he will be there with him today. There is a moment in which you can choose. And it's not dependent on anything that the criminal can do. It's not based on what the criminal has done. You don't earn what Jesus has done for you. It's free. It's what the Bible describes as grace. So it doesn't matter what you or I have done. Jesus paid the penalty for it. And Jesus' encounter with the criminal shows us that you don't need to go through some kind of special ceremony or to carry out certain actions in order to be eligible to accept the offer. It is absolutely free. And if you are still breathing, and I really hope that you are, if not, we'll call some medics and we'll pray, then it's not too late. You can still choose. But you have to choose. Right, now, I can tell you all about Gavin's cakes. I can show you pictures of Gavin's cakes. And this evening, I can go better than I did this morning. Yes. Because, well, perhaps I should get you to get it out of the box. This is much better if you get it out of the box. It's going to be a disaster if I do this. It won't be paradise. It's going to be paradise cake on the floor. The thing is, that cake looks gorgeous, right? But unless you eat it, you are not going to know how good it tastes. Now, the challenge is that some of us don't really fully accept what Jesus has done. Tim Mackey's got a number of sermons, and he's really got a great talk about, in John's Gospel, Jesus' final words on the cross, it is finished. And in that, he makes a couple of points, which I want to say again here. That some of us, perhaps, don't accept what Jesus fully has done for us because maybe we don't think we've actually done anything wrong. After all, I'm not a criminal, am I? It would be easy to think, I'm basically a good person. I don't hurt anyone else. But the problem is, that's not good enough, actually, because we all have fallen short of that original design. Perhaps we don't accept because we can't accept that anyone else could carry the burden of another person's sin. In fact, this is what the Quran teaches. Perhaps we don't fully accept what Jesus has done because we're so weighed down with guilt. Perhaps we carry on thinking and feeling that guilt about the things that we've done, that shame. We start to act as if Jesus didn't die on the cross at all. Perhaps you think you're not good enough, a bit like this character here. This is Rodriguez in the film The Mission, which is slightly less gruesome than The Passion of Christ. And in this scene, we see Rodriguez, who was a former slave trader, and what he's doing is dragging all his previous symbols of his previous life, his armor. I know some of you would have seen me use this illustration before because I think it's such a good, it captures so well what some of us do inside ourselves when we're just dragging around all the stuff from our past. And in the film, he's shown going up a large mountain, and then at the top, he's cut free from his burden, which is just such a brilliant picture of what Jesus does for us. Perhaps you find it really hard to fully accept what Jesus has done because you've messed up again. Perhaps it's like that picture that John explained at the end of the worship where the doors are stuck and they're coming back. And it's, I'm here again. Perhaps you've been a Christian for years and actually that's the situation. How can God forgive you? Well, Lamentations 3 tells us that his mercy is new every morning. We need to remember who Yahweh is. Abounding in love and compassion, forgiving every kind of sin. Perhaps we find it hard to fully accept Jesus' offer because it just seems so narrow-minded to claim that there's only one way to get rid of your sin and to be with God. And that's actually something that is really quite difficult for me because I live and I work and I teach in a worldview where there is no single authority anymore, where there's this idea that there could be one real truth is completely rejected. And so to say the words that Jesus does in John 16, verse 4, where he says, "I am the only way to God and the real truth and the real life. No one comes to the Father but through me," is actually, for me, quite difficult if I want to get that out of my mouth somehow to my colleagues for whom that idea is like way, way out there. And so for me, actually preparing this talk, on one hand was like, this is very simple. This is something I have known all my life. And yet the other, to actually get that out of my mouth to people that I work with, is extraordinarily difficult. But as I've been wrestling with this, as I've been preparing this talk, I've come to the conclusion that Jesus' offer is actually not as narrow-minded as it might seem, because the picture of his kingdom in Luke is not that of an elite system that's only open to a few. His offer is open to anyone, and that is what the two criminals show us. As he says in John 3:16, everyone who believes in him may have eternal life. And that is as true today as it was 2,000 years ago. So I'd like us to watch a short clip now from one of the Alpha videos that helps bring that home.
By 1995, I was a tramp, and I didn't realise this then. The inside of my body was shutting down, so all I did was drink, take drugs, didn't eat. I didn't realise I was getting septicemia. I had malnutrition and dehydration. In March of 1996, some people turned up on the street and they said to me, "Do you know Jesus loves you?" And I chased them. Jesus, my nana sang about Jesus when I was a kid. There's no such thing. A week after they came back, and I seen these Christian men and women on the street for the next 6 months. One morning I woke up, it was just a normal day. I got my drink and my drugs and I collapsed. I was rushed to hospital. I was in a coma for 6 days. My mother was asked to come to the hospital. She went to the hospital. I was dead. I'd had my last rites on the sixth day. Consultant said to my mum that there's nothing they can do. So she said, "Can I have a few more hours to think about it?" So my mum went out of the room, and there was a lot of people there come to say goodbye to me. And then Tony, my mate, said, "My mum, there's some Christian lads here." And my mum went, "Well, what good's that gonna do? How can that help him? He's dead." And they said, "Well, let us pray for him." So they went and prayed for me, and they put their hands on my head, and they said, "In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, give this man new life." And I woke up, sat up, pulled the mask out my mouth. I was alive, come back to life. But it wasn't just a miraculous waking up of the coma. I woke up totally different. I knew I'd never drink again or take drugs or smoke. I wanted to help people. I actually thought I'd gone insane, to be honest. And these Christian men said to me, "Do you know what, Grant? You need to go on an Alpha course." So I said, "What's one of them?" We went on the day away. So on the third talk on the afternoon, and I stood up and I said, "Jesus," this is the exact words, I've never forgot it. It was November the 9th, 1996, at 2:45. And I said, "Jesus, and I've been told you love me, and I kind of believe that you love me. But it's not enough. I need to know something in my heart." And as I said that, and I said, "Sorry, will you come into my life?" I fell back into my chair and I was crying. I couldn't stop. At that moment, as them tears flooded out my eyes, I knew where I was from. I knew who I was, and I knew what I had to do. So that night at 10 o'clock, I went back to the streets of Middlesbrough, full of Jesus, and I began my ministry. That was 19 years ago. And ever since then, that's what I've done. I've gone, I've told people about Jesus, I've run 141 Alpha courses. There's a couple of things I say to people on the streets or in the prison when I first meet them, because they're full of doubt, you know, I was doubtful. And I say, "Well, Grandma, how do you really know that, you know, you didn't just wake up out of a coma?" Now, maybe I did just come out of that coma by coincidence, but I often say, for the last 19 years, why have I lived how I have? You know, where did the violence go? Where did the anger and the rejection and not knowing about love, where did that go in one night? Jesus is supreme love. That's what changes. That's what changed Graham Seed. So if it changed Graham Seed, it does for anyone.
Yeah. Okay, well, maybe Graham Seed's situation was a bit extreme, and maybe that's not where you and I are. But I really wanted to show that as such a powerful testimony of the transformation that is possible. That when you say yes to Jesus, he transforms your life. And the offer is that you can do life with him, fully with him, fully free of every kind of sin and shame. So I just want to close really by saying that if you haven't accepted Jesus' offer yet, today you can be with him in paradise if you want. But you have to choose. You have to choose. Maybe you've got questions and your choice is, all right, I'm going to really take those questions seriously. I'm going to dig. I'm going to find out more about Jesus. That's great. I've got some books. You can take them away. You can have them. If that's you, I have been praying for you ever since I knew this was the topic I've been given to talk about. You can have my very weighty tome and be historically convinced of the reality of Jesus. But please don't go away without thinking about it seriously. Come and talk to us. Come and pray with us. We would love to pray with you. Maybe for some of us, we need to actually be much freer with how we share the good news. This is something I felt really challenged about. And when I was watching that video this morning in this morning service, I just thought, what would have happened if those guys had not been talking to him about Jesus? What if they hadn't gone to the hospital and just had a go at praying? Maybe we need to get a bit freer about sharing our faith. Well, I certainly do, at any rate. I also think there are people that maybe are here who you've had your expectations of Jesus in a particular way, and he wants to change them. He wants to tell you he's more than what you're expecting, and if you think he's disappointed you or let you down, he wants to show you what he's really doing. Maybe you accepted Jesus a really long time ago, and actually, despite the fact that we sing beautiful songs, the cross has become a little bit dull, and we need to come back again to the amazing wonder of what Jesus has done for us. Maybe it's not a case that you're captive, like physically captive, but maybe actually inside you're trapped under a load of guilt, and Jesus wants to just set you free from that once and for all.
We hope you enjoyed the talk and found it helpful.
Why not come along and visit us? We gather at 3 services across 2 sites on a Sunday and meet during the week in small groups across the city. More information on both of these can be found on our website.
Thanks for listening, and God bless.